Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 9th, 1999. And in the fireside room this morning is Barbara Rossing. Today's session number is 99-5, and it is titled Revelation 5, Tree of Life in God's New Jerusalem. Let's listen to Barbara.
And you can divide it differently, but it's got this concentric shape, and then C prime, B prime, A prime. That it's that the things are related to each other. So the beginning and the end are related in parallel fashion. The second and the second to the last thing are related. And the middle stuff is related around this concentric middle that probably turns around chapter 12, where we saw that Satan is thrown out of heaven, around there anyway. And it's not so important where you make the distinction. But what's important is to see this parallel structure idea, if you buy it, and most scholars do. Schistler Fiorenzo was the first one to propose it, I think in 1968. She develops it in this book. Pablo Richard picks up on it, although he divides the passages a little bit differently. But what it means for us is that the New Jerusalem vision fulfills the things that were promised in those seven opening letters. You can see in her structure, the seven letters here are what she calls the B section, and then they're fulfilled here in the B prime section, which is the New Jerusalem right here. So how they work, those promises, is that they empower you to continue through the terrible middle section of the book, the difficult part. In each of the seven letters, it was a specific thing, and let's see how your memory is. The first one was to the church of Ephesus. Christ was the one who is in the midst of the seven lampstands. There the promise was, to the one who conquers, I will give what? Anybody remember? In chapter 2, the first letter? It was permission to eat of the tree of life that is in the paradise of God. Now the tree of life is going to come back in the New Jerusalem vision. Other promises, like a new name. To the one who conquers, I will give a new name. I will make a pillar in the temple of my God, it says in the letter to Philadelphia. And in the New Jerusalem, which is descending down from heaven, this is in chapter 3. That now is fulfilled in the New Jerusalem vision. So that's the first thing, is to see how the book kind of, how the Tree of Life is kind of a bookend to the book, really. The Tree of Life is a very important image in Revelation. It gets you revved up at the beginning, revved up to want to be one of those overcomers, to want to endure. And then at the end, it's a bookend. It's fulfilled there where we enter God's holy city. And we'll see a really important... The New Jerusalem vision is also the opposite of Babylon. And that's what I want to look at next. We looked at the Babylon vision yesterday, and Babylon was this world of buying and selling. It centered around the merchants. That they were the center of chapter 18. Remember, we had this threefold lament of the kings, the merchants, and the mariners, and then and everybody had to have money in order to be able to trade in this economy. The whole issue was that if God's people don't take the mark of the beast, they can't buy or sell. Babylon is a world of buying and selling. God's New Jerusalem is the opposite of that, where the gifts and the essentials of life and health in New Jerusalem are given, and this is the Greek word here, without cost, as a gift, without payment, without money. Dorian is the word. And that's a very important contrast. There's all kinds of other contrasts. You could go ad nauseum. These are the ones that a guy named Gerhard Krodel has in his book. But we're going to look at the ways the two visions are clearly structured in order for you to see the parallels between them, so that you're to reject the city on the left-hand side and then embrace this city, God's New Jerusalem. And you don't have to worry about the details. I mean, this is stuff I use with my classes. You're on vacation. You don't have to. But the important thing is to see that there are contrasts, and you've got to make a choice here. So let's look at, if someone would be willing, why don't you open your Bibles to the beginning of the Babylon vision, chapter 17. And I'll read from chapter 21, and you'll hear how closely structured they are as parallels. Chapter 17 is what we looked at yesterday, so you'll remember that. Okay, I'm going to read at the same time that you read that. I'll read from chapter 21, verse 9, and you'll see all the parallels. Because I'm going to read the New Jerusalem introduction. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. Yeah. See how that's the same? And spoke to me, saying, come, I will show you. And that's exactly the same phrase, come, I will show you. It only appears three times in the book. So obviously, if both cities have it, it's parallel here. Come, I will show you. And then this is different. In the New Jerusalem vision, it's the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And what was it with Babylon?
The great whore.
Yeah, the judgment of the great whore. So obviously, it's a different. So both cities are introduced first as a feminine figure, but it's in very parallel fashion. And then in the spirit, the angel carried me away to. And then the place is different, but both of them have in the spirit, I was carried away to. Okay, and in the case of the New Jerusalem vision, it's to a great high mountain. And what was it with Babylon?
A wilderness,
or a wasteland, uh-huh. And so you can see how the introductions to the two visions are very consciously reminding you of one another, so that when you see New Jerusalem, you know, oh yes, this is the alternative world that I'm supposed to participate in if I'm renouncing Babylon and coming out of that. Well, we'll look at some of these other contrasts, and you'll remember them too from the Babylon vision. The city that comes down in chapter 21 is a beautiful city with all these wonderful jewels. We'll look at it in a second. I just want to show a few more overheads, and then I'll put the screen back up. Again, if you read the visions literally, you end up with some kind of tricky images. This is, it's kind of an ugly transparency here, but this is a beautiful Flemish tapestry called The Marriage of the Lamb from chapter 19 and then chapter 21. You can see if you literally depict the city like a bride and you depict her as a woman and you depict Jesus literally as a lamb, then this is what you end up with at the end, The Marriage of the Lamb. And this sheep and this woman are getting married. I would suggest, however, that we're not meant to read the images of Revelation literally. Because no one wants to see that kind of wedding. It's not a Christian wedding. Instead, I mean, it's metaphorical. This is the woodcut from Luther's Bible by Lucas Cranach of the Holy City, New Jerusalem. Here's the angels taking me, come, I will show you. And he shows me this holy city. Notice it looks a lot like a medieval German town. That's how, I mean, I think Luther and Cranach were wonderful in doing this. They wanted the readers of the Bible to be able to see themselves in God's holy city, to see it as a city that they could relate to, the image. And I think that's what we're called to do too. Here's the river. It's the river that flows through Wittenberg, but it's also the river that flows from the throne of God through the holy city. I mean, it's a river that people know and recognize, but also dream of. And I think that's how the New Jerusalem vision works for us. We're to see it as familiar enough that we recognize, yes, it's a city, we can relate to that. And then it's a beautiful city. It's extraordinary. It's radiant. It's like a bride in the sense of it's new and wondrous, radiant. And the call of this vision then is to us to see ourselves as participants in the city and what it means to catch glimpses of it, even in our cities that surely sometimes fall short of this vision. Let's read the beginning of chapter 21. Whoops. If somebody would be willing to read chapter 21, verses 1 through 7. This is the first description of this beautiful new city. And this is the passage that I argue says that there's not a rapture in Revelation. Indeed, if anything, it's God who gets raptured down to earth. And see what you think of this vision here. This is then after the millennium, right after the millennium and the last judgment, chapter 21, if somebody'd be willing to read here.
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And he who sat upon the throne said, behold, I will make all things new. Also he said, write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give from the fountain of the water of life without payment. He who conquers shall have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son.
Okay. And in the new RSV, it says, they will be my children. It's a little more inclusive there to include all of us. Notice in verse 6, to the thirsty I will give from the fountain of the water of life without payment. Or your translation might have as a gift, or anything else that you've got there. That's this Greek word dorion that we'll see again in chapter 22. It specifically means no money. I was working, I was probably 4 years into my dissertation working on this text, and I went on a trip to Greece. And so we were driving around Greece and Turkey in these vans, and we passed a mobile station, you know, with the flying horse, just like our mobile stations. And the sign out in front said in Greek, poterion dorion. Well, poterion is the word in the Last Supper when Jesus takes a cup, gives thanks, blesses it. It's the Greek word for cup. But what was so funny on this sign is they had a picture of a glass, you know, like just a plain kitchen glass. And suddenly I realized what they're saying is free glass with a fill-up. Remember how we used to have that? We don't have those promotions anymore. But that was it. It was a glass, and then it was dorion, without payment, a free glass if you fill up. So that really helped me understand both what poterion is. I mean, it's just simply a cup or a glass. Jesus took a cup, a drinking cup. And then this idea of dorion, that you don't have to pay for something. I mean, it's really this sort of economic reminder that these words that we think are so theological are actually also just plain, you know, everyday economic words. It dorion still in Greece today means you don't have to pay for something. And that's what's going on in this vision. Whereas in Babylon, you had to pay for stuff. And those who didn't have the money and couldn't afford it were left out of God's holy city. In God's new Jerusalem, the essentials of life, the water of life, is given without payment. That's a really important thing here. What else do you notice about this vision? What do you like or not like? Anything strike you as it was being read?
The imagery in verse 4 about no crying or pain.
Yeah. We saw that in chapter 7. That verse, it's a verse from Isaiah. Mm-hmm. And remember the interlude vision that we looked at in chapter 7 between the sixth and the seventh seal? Same thing there. The Lamb will shelter them and will lead them to springs of water, and there will be no more crying or pain. He will wipe away all tears from their eyes. It's a beautiful image of comfort. It's used twice here in Revelation. Uh-huh. Were you going to say more? I sort of interrupted there.
No.
Okay. Uh-huh.
One thing I noticed in verse 6, and it says, it is done, the first thing that came to my mind is, that's what Jesus said on the cross.
Ah, it is finished, uh-huh.
And I'm like, well, it's a real tie into, well, it's not the Old Testament, but...
Uh-huh. Into the life of Jesus, yeah. And it's this idea that it really has happened. Yeah, it's the perfect tense in Greek, just like it is on the cross when Jesus says, tetelestai, it has been fulfilled. Here it is, it has been done, essentially. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well, more along the lines of what you were saying earlier, in verse 3, that the home of God, and I don't know what that is. Let's see, there's a footnote here, the tent or the tabernacle.
It's skeining is the Greek word. Uh-huh.
Is among mortals. I mean, in some ways it sounds kind of arrogant that our, I don't know what the Greek is there, but that our species, humans, God is the dwelling place among species, among humans. And that's kind of a neat vision, that the place of God is rightly among his people.
Yeah, it's exactly the same Greek word that's used in the beginning of the Gospel of John, where it says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We read that text on Christmas Day every year. It's so wonderful. It's incarnational. God coming to make a tent in our midst. It's this Greek word, skene. The verb is skeno, and it really means God is coming to pitch a tent in our midst. And that's what's going on here, too, in this vision, is that God's home comes to be among people, among mortals. So that's why it's right on the basis of that I'm arguing that indeed the throne of God, which we saw in chapter 4, is really up in heaven.
now in the New Jerusalem vision comes in to be on earth. And you'll see that at the beginning of chapter 22. The throne is in our midst. God pitches a tent with us. Uh-huh.
Okay. I think it's intriguing in the first verse. I'm interested to hear where you're going to go with this in terms of ecological concern. That there is no more sea.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I just know from some of the stuff that I've seen that the comments over the years I've run into that the Hebrews and probably the carryover to the New Testament were landlubbers. They're very uncomfortable around the watery chaos of the oceans.
Yeah.
It was very threatening. And that the sea is either like glass, so if there's no storm at all, it's totally calm, or there's no sea at all.
Uh-huh.
Which doesn't make any sense ecologically.
Right.
So
we don't want to live in a world, all right, why don't I say something about that? It is funny that given that, those of you who have been to Israel, they've got great beaches and stuff, go to Tel Aviv all the way up the coast. Why are they so scared of the oceans in the Old Testament? Hard to know. They were most at home in the hill country and least comfortable along the beaches, and that's reflected throughout the Old Testament. And it's sort of sad, a new heaven, new earth, and the sea is no more. My argument on that is that by this point, remember, Rome owned the entire Mediterranean Sea. They had conquered everything all around it, North Africa, all the way around the Middle East and up through Europe. So basically, and you'll see this in classical writers, a guy named Aelius Aristides, for example, talks about it as Rome's lake, basically. This is Rome's ocean by now, and the ships go back and forth. So my ecological take on it is that the reason he says the sea was no more is not that he hates oceans, but rather that he hates the shipping trade, and that his way of saying there will be no more commerce, because indeed New Jerusalem has no harbor. It's not a port city. The way he gets rid of the commerce is by saying there will be no more sea, so there will no more ships will be sailing back and forth. And remember in chapter 18, the cargo list, it was all the things that were being brought on the ships. It was the ivory, it was the gold, the silver, the silk, the pearls, the purple, the logs, the timbers, the precious scented wood. It was everything, and the slaves, that is human souls. It was all the things that was brought back and forth on the ships that he singles out sort of for that middle and central section of the lament there. And I think my theory is that that's why he says there's no more sea, is that's the clearest signal, there's no more commerce. Uh-huh.
How do you react to the fact that in Revelation, the sea, the beast coming out of the sea, is a metaphor representing out of the nations or out of the peoples of the world at that time. And how do you equate this sea to that kind of a sea?
Well, I don't read it as the peoples and nations in chapter 13. It is, there's the beast from the sea and the beast from the land. I think there the beast from the sea is Rome. Even though Rome itself was located a little bit inland, its port city was Ostia. I think that's what it's referring to as Rome is coming from the sea. That's how I read that one. But it's the sea is a bad character in the book of Revelation. Let's just say there's no really good sea here. So he knows what's good and what's bad. The sea is bad, and it's consistent throughout. So I think it is the same sea. Yeah. But it's all, there's other interpretations of it too. That's just how I'm reading it. And certainly no one else shares my ecological opinion on this chapter 21. I should say that. This is a, no one else agrees with me on this one, on why he's getting rid of the sea. So you definitely can disagree with me on other stuff too. Uh-huh.
Well, the sea has a parallel in heaven, and what separates everyone else from God. I mean, God is in the center of a glassy sea, while everyone else is hovering around. It's almost like there's
Is that the same word, though? I don't think so in chapter 4. Is it a sea?
Is that the same Greek word?
It's thalassa here. I don't know. Let's see. Okay, so yeah. And I think we can't keep having this attitude about the ocean. I mean, obviously, we've used the ocean as a trash heap for a long time. I mean, we've got to change our relationship to the oceans. If he's got a phobia and a fear of the oceans, we can't continue, or we continue only at our peril. It is thalassa there. Okay, a sea as of crystal in verse 6 in chapter 4. Okay. All right, well, let's keep on. Uh-huh, did you have a comment? Yes.
Well, this vision of the New Jerusalem is interesting, but it continues in verse 8 with
yes, it
people
does.
Who are the cowardly, the faithless, and all, they're not going to go into the New Jerusalem. How do you include those two?
All right, good point. And I was going to skip that verse, but I'll deal with it. Because, yeah, you see it in verse 8. It's what's called a vice list, very similar to other vice lists in the New Testament. You also see it in chapter 21. Verse 27, nothing unclean shall enter it, nor anyone who practices abomination or falsehood. And you see it again in chapter 22. Well, there you have to decide as an interpreter, if you read Revelation in the sense of prediction, predicting a script for end time events and predictive, then you'll say it's predicting that some are going to get into God's city and some are going to be left out. And we know already who it is, or God knows, because some of them are written in the Lamb's Book of Life and some of them aren't. And the ones that aren't, they're going to be thrown in the pit of fire, the lake of fire with all these evildoers. That's a predictive kind of reading of Revelation. That's certainly the dominant American cultural reading, is that Revelation is a script for the end time events. The argument that Elizabeth Schuster Fiorenza makes is that we're to read these vice lists and passages like this not so much as prediction as exhortation. That they're meant to be a wake-up call to all of us, to everyone. It's not that the list is sort of preordained, predestined, but it's rather the idea that John, throughout the book of Revelation, is using a kind of carrot and stick approach to get us to come out of Babylon, to get us to repent. And the carrot is this beautiful vision of a holy city where tears will be wiped away. I mean, it's a lovely city. We're going to see in a minute. It's got pearly gates. It's got golden streets. It's gorgeous. You want to be part of that city. That's the carrot part. And the stick part, then, is these vice lists and threats that are meant to be wake-up calls that are scaring us. And then that she argues that they're not sort of predictions so much as they're this exhortation to us not to be found among the cowardly, faithless, polluted, murderers, fornicators, sorcerers, idolaters, and liars whose place is in the lake of fire. But it's meant to be sure that your place isn't in the lake of fire. Indeed, that you're a participant, a citizen in God's New Jerusalem. But those are two different ways to read those verses. Uh-huh.
But hasn't that been taken care of in verse 20 or chapter 20?
Yeah, with the last judgment?
Yeah.
Well, yes, if you read the book sequentially, it has been, because that's where the one who sits on the great white throne, God, is sort of judging, and on the basis of your works is judging.
Well, why would he bring that in verse 21 when this is a beautiful image of life for us, the Christian being? This is our reward. And yet he brings this verse 8, which he's already dealt with in chapter 20.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why I guess I would argue that the book can't be just laid out sequentially, because things that should have been taken care of keep consistently popping up. I mean, in chapter 7, there are things there that should have been taken care of in chapter 6. There's a lot of repetition in the book of Revelation. These exhortations keep coming back. There's a sort of almost a cyclical sense in the way that stuff does keep coming back. It's not like a logic that is laid out where things get taken care of once and then they're gone. It's more, Schuster Fiorenza talks about it as a sort of a conic, kind of a spiral almost. Things do come back. And you can't sort of logically lay it out as a progression. It's rather this sort of evocative sense. And yeah, it's sort of startling and indeed disconcerting that just after he describes this beautiful vision of the holy city, then again he's got these vice lists, and that's a consistent pattern. And chapter 22 also, can't get around it. It's stuff does keep coming back. I'm just offering one suggestion to you, I guess, is that the way you can deal with that is an exhortation. That's a possibility anyway. And scholars are divided on it. But yeah, just what you point out, that things keep coming back in Revelation in unexpected ways, it's interesting. And indeed, a question you could ask about chapter 21 is, why does New Jerusalem come down twice? Because you just read chapter 21 here, verse 1 through 8, and in chapter 21, verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. Well, I already read to you 21 verse 9. It comes down again. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Verse 10, in the spirit he carried me away to a great high mountain, showed me the holy city coming down. Wow. okay, did he forget that he just wrote it? In no, stuff keeps coming back. I mean, it's a kind of a, there's a repetition of revelation that's sort of wonderful. The first time it's descended, it's more in terms of what he hears. He hears the voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God was with people. The second time the descent is described, it's more in terms of what he sees. Now he's going on a tour, a visual tour of God's New Jerusalem, seeing the layout. And it's that's where he gets to see, you know, with the measuring rod, how big things are. It's a huge city with this huge wall, these 12 gates, the gemstones, the names on the gate. It's a square. It's a cubic city, really. It's enormous. Let's take a look at it. Let's go on that tour briefly and see what this city looks like. And I'll point out some favorite things to you. Are any of you working in lapidary this week at all? Doing anything with gemstones?
Yeah.
All right. What one are you working on?
I just started. I picked my stone, so we're back. It's obsidian.
Obsidian. Okay, that's not in this list.
Okay, well.
Too bad. But in verses 19 through 20, you've got one of the longest gemstone lists in the Bible here. The foundation of the wall of the city were adorned with every jewel. And remember, there were jewels in Babylon, too. They were the jewelry that was worn by the harlot Babylon. And here, however, jewels are offered to everyone. I mean, you can all walk on these golden streets. You can all see these bejeweled foundations. So it's not that jewels themselves are bad. I think it's just that it's the that it's meant to be shared with everyone. So you've got this gemstone list here. Verse 21, the gates are made each of a single pearl. The street of the city is gold, transparent as glass. Verse 22 is an important one. I saw no temple in the city. For its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. The whole city now becomes a holy place. And all of us are priests. Remember, the whole people of God is called to be a priest in this New Jerusalem vision. The city has no need of sun nor moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God is its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light shall the nations walk. It's a real open kind of a city. Verse 25, its gates shall never be shut by day, and there shall be no night there. So basically, when are the gates shut?
Never.
You know, what does that say to us now in our country? We're one of the fastest growing kinds of neighborhoods that we're building is these gated communities. Maybe some of you live in one. I mean, I know they're very popular, but the whole idea is to keep people out. Well, New Jerusalem is not that kind of a gated community. You never shut the gates.
It's almost in a way a kind of a reversal of the creation account in Genesis. There is no sun, no moon, no division, no demarcation.
I hadn't thought of that. Because God is so radiant. This is all the light you need. Yeah. Well, and the creation is certainly picked up. Let's take a look at chapter 22, because this is my favorite part, and this is where we're going to see the tree of life again, and this is where we get the Holden theme and the river of life. I changed my mind. Let's look first at Ezekiel 47, okay? I want it, because I said the third thing I wanted to look at is how this picks up on Old Testament hopes and dreams. So turn to Ezekiel 47, if you would. John is drawing heavily on Ezekiel here, and it's a beautiful vision. Ezekiel chapter 40 to 48 is the new temple vision, where after the old temple has been so trashed, Ezekiel says, by foreigners and by unclean people that it's been destroyed. Then he's got his oracles against the nations. And then the new temple is envisioned in chapters 40 to 48. And it's quite a detailed tour that he gets to the new temple, much like the tour of the city, New Jerusalem, in Revelation 21. And my favorite part of it is the end of the vision here in chapter 47. For those of you who have Bibles like this, it's on page 840, but you all have different page numbers. Ezekiel's hard to find. He's after Jeremiah, after Isaiah, before Daniel. And this is talking about how this new temple is glorious and radiant, and then out of the temple is going to be flowing this river. And it's such a wonderful, hopeful vision. Because remember, Israel is a really dry land, and water is very precious. So the water gets deeper and deeper. First, it's ankle deep coming out of the temple, then it's knee deep, then it's waist deep. I had to preach on this text in Grand Forks, North Dakota, the year after the flood. And that wasn't a helpful kind of image of water. But in places where water is scarce, this idea of this water coming out of the temple and then down to the Dead Sea, those of you who have been there know how dry, and it's a total desert, that road from Jerusalem down to Jericho and the Dead Sea. So this idea of water that gives life to everything would be wonderful. Look at verse 7 here. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on the one side and on the other. The angel said to me, this water flows towards the eastern region. Then it's described where it flows. When it enters the sea of stagnant waters, that's the Dead Sea, the water will become fresh. The Dead Sea is so salty that things can't live there, but the water will become fresh. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish once these waters reach there. It will become fresh, and everything will live where the river goes. People will stand fishing on the banks of the sea. Beautiful. Ein Gedi, maybe you've been there. And then verse 11 is so wonderful. I mean, he knows the ecology of this, but its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt, because he knows some of the creatures need salt water or brackish water. It's just beautiful. On the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. Mm. Isn't that a nice vision? Okay, but it gets even better in the book of Revelation. No, I think Ezekiel 47 is a beautiful vision, but you'll see that the opening verses of chapter 22 are clearly based on this. John knows his scripture. He's probably got the Old Testament memorized. I mean, he's really scripture grounded. So he's drawing on this Old Testament vision of Ezekiel, but then he's making it even more expansive and wonderful and life-giving. And so look for the changes that he makes. You'll see him. He makes several important changes here. If someone would be willing to read chapter 22, well, let's just do verses 1 to 2. This is kind of the Holden theme here. In Revelation now, back to Revelation.
And the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb.
Okay, that's a change right there. Where was it flowing from in Ezekiel? The temple. Well, here he's already said in chapter 21 there's no temple in God's holy city. So what there is the throne of God in the center of the city. Okay, sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Through the middle of the street of the city, on either side of the river is the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations.
Okay. So what do you notice? What's similar? What's different? Yeah, both passages say that the leaves of the tree are for healing. Ezekiel had that as well. Its fruit will not fail, its leaves are for healing. But there's one word that's added in Revelation.
Nations.
Yeah, nations. It's for the healing of the nations. And John does that over and over. He adds in the nations where Ezekiel doesn't. Ezekiel's is a priestly vision. We call him a priestly writer. He's very concerned that foreigners be kept out of God's holy city. That's just the Ezekiel. Isaiah and other prophets include the nations a lot, but Ezekiel doesn't. Ezekiel's got gates on the temple to keep people out. He wants foreigners and those who are unclean, who are not worthy, are not permitted to enter the temple. It's a purity kind of vision. John sort of transforms that vision, draws on it, uses it, but then adds nations, brings in the foreigners, just where Ezekiel leaves them out. So the leaves of the tree are not only for healing, they're for the healing of the nations. It's a wonderful kind of expansion. And we saw the nations also in chapter 21, verse 24, by its light shall the nations walk. There's nations all over, walking all over God's holy city, New Jerusalem, foreigners, all the ethnic groups, the nations. What else? Anything else? What about the tree?
Both passages refer to that the tree produces 12 kinds of fruit, one for each month.
Yeah, and someone was saying at the first session, isn't it wonderful the diversity? I mean, we've got this tree that can produce all these different kinds of fruits. We don't all have to be eating apples the same day. I mean, it's a tree that, you know, you got pears, apples, oranges, everything. It's diversity. 12 kinds of fruit, one each month, never fails. It's ever-bearing. Yeah, both visions have the ever-bearing tree.
Very efficient.
Yeah, very efficient. Well, it's wondrous. Notice, did Ezekiel have the tree of life? No, he didn't. Ezekiel had very many trees on both sides of the banks. I mean, it's obviously a wondrous tree whose leaves are for the healing, but it's not the tree of life. So what John does is take Ezekiel's vision and then combine it with the Genesis text about the Garden of Eden, because John says it's the tree of life. And that means it's this tree from paradise that is promised to those in the letter to Ephesus. To those who conquer, I will give permission to eat of the tree of life. Now we see this tree of life in God's holy city. So he's making it sort of even better than Ezekiel. Ezekiel's wonderful. John goes one better than that. It's the tree of life.
There's a footnote on that tree of life. Can you explain that?
Well, it's the problem.
It's the lamb.
Yeah, it does say. No, it doesn't mean it's the tree of life.
What I take that to mean is the river is the lamb, as opposed to the river is the tree of life. I wonder, is that different in some?
Oh, no, I don't. Yeah. All right, let's see. What is that? No, the problem in that verse is, let's see, verse 2. And Tuthen, Poyon, Hena. There isn't. Yeah, I'm looking at the Greek here. There's no verses that add in. I think what it is, it's a substitute verse. It's not that the river is the lamb, it's the problem of how to get one tree, because John knows in Ezekiel you've got many trees and in Genesis you only have one tree of life. So he wants to have the tree of life, but he's got to have it grow on both sides of the river. That's the problem. So I think what it is, it's substituting, it's going back to the end of verse 1, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of the city and on either side of the river was the tree of life. That's how it would read in the other manuscript version. So it's a problem of how to have the same tree grow on both sides of the river.
Why does it have it growing on both sides of the river?
Because he wants to have it be beautiful. I mean, it wouldn't be as pretty to have only one tree, I think. You know, he wants to have it be like Ezekiel, where there's banks of the river that are lined with these beautiful trees, but there's only one tree of life. So maybe it's like... aren't there some plants that, you know, send up rhizomes or something, all, you know, it's wondrous. But he's got to get it both places and have it be singular. I mean, the solution would be to just say trees of life. But that's not faithful to the Genesis account that only has one tree. So it's, you know, and in your image, well, I guess the art that we have in the Village Center and on the theme art sort of has this tree in the middle that kind of has roots that straddle both sides of the river. That's one way to do it, and then goes out both ways. However you envision it, that's what the tricky thing is here. But it's a wondrous tree, and it grows in along the banks. I see it everywhere along. But, I mean, how do you see it? That's, I think, the invitation to you is to see yourself in this city, along the banks of this river, this wondrous river of life, partaking of this tree, and envision yourself as participating in this vision. That's the invitation. Because we're there. I had a young friend, a child, I'd read her bedtime stories, and she'd want to know in every story, where am I in that story? Well, you know, so you have to put her into the book that you're reading, you know, put Kaya into this story. But you're here, you're in this vision. You're not just a spectator, you're a participant. In verse 3, no longer shall anything be accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it. His servants shall worship God. They shall see God's face. God's name will be on their foreheads. So we're worshiping and serving. We're participating in this vision. So wherever you see yourself along the banks of that river, eating off those trees, getting healed by their leaves, enjoying the water without charge, without money, you're there in the vision. And that's what I want to open up and talk about. Just a glimpse here of this. I just got in the mail a copy of this new draft of a Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River watershed. And it's really wonderful. They talk about all the rivers that make up the Columbia River watershed. I had no idea that it goes so far east. They're saying that the Flathead and the Clark rivers in Montana are part of this, that the rivers of British Columbia are all part of the Columbia River watershed. They name all these rivers. Maybe some of you live in this watershed. How many of you are somewhere in the Columbia River watershed? Any of you? Well, not too many. But, I mean, all these rivers are named. The Spokane, the Metow, the Wenatchee. Maybe you drove along that coming here. The Yakima. The Okanagan right over here. They're all named. And then what it says, I lost the place here, is the Columbia River watershed should have living water. Suddenly it's not just the Columbia, the Yakima, the Wenatchee. It's the living water. It's the river of life flowing from the throne of God. Think of your watershed in light of that. What are the names of some of the rivers flowing through your cities? You've all got one probably. Detroit River?
Ohio?
Mississippi?
The Salt River, which is dry.
Oh, the Salt River? Okay, it's not always dry though. It's sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
They dammed it up. Really?
Okay, well, let's talk about that because that's part of what's addressed in this Columbia River letters. You know, what does it mean when we dam up the rivers? What harm or what are the trade offs there? Other rivers?
Kankakee.
Oh, okay. Snoqualmie?
Hudson.
Cedar.
We have a creek that's usually dry unless it's in the wintertime called Francisquito Creek. But mostly it's a home for, mostly it's a shelter for homeless.
Okay. Well?
We've got the California Aqueduct.
My gosh, these are some strange sounding rivers. Okay. It goes to show how much we've changed the landscape. Well, we've got Railroad Creek out here. You know, so think of all these watersheds and then just start imagining what would it mean if that river flowing through your town, the Kankakee or whatever the funniest, you know, the California Aqueduct, is actually, it starts at the throne of God, flowing from the heart of God. And it's God's river of life flowing through your city. What would that mean? Because I think that's what this vision calls us to, is to imagine our cities and towns not as places that we have to escape from to, you know, come up to Holden Village to get revived or whatever, but as places where we really can experience there the river of the water of life flowing from the heart of God, from the throne of God, the tree of life with its wondrous fruits, with its beautiful leaves that are for healing. I mean, this is an extraordinary vision that can bring healing to our cities, to our towns, to our rivers. And however scrawny the trees are in your place, I mean, I think that it's those glimpses of God's vision, God's city, that are what this vision is about. It's invitational. It's calling us to imagine ourselves as letting go of Babylon and whatever it is we cling to there, renouncing the seductions of the evil city and the commercial economy in our lives, and being willing to embrace and participate and imagine and envision ourselves along a different river as citizens of a different city, and living in terms of that community, that vision. Have you glimpsed this holy city, this wondrous river, this tree? Where have you seen it? Let's hear some stories, because we need to help one another with our imaginations of how you see that vision in your life. Uh-huh.
Well, I know, and I live not too far from the Columbia River. It goes right through the Tri-Cities. And I find it is a place of healing when, after a crazy week, I just feel so bruised from things that went on during there. On my day off, to jog down to the banks and sit. And there are lots of trees, and it's very beautiful, and many seagulls and geese and that sort of thing. But a healing does take place. There's something with the sound of the water, the wind, and everything else that has a healing effect. It's beautiful.
A glimpse of New Jerusalem right there in Richland. Others? Uh-huh. Laura?
I live in New York City, and our church is two blocks from Central Park. And when Central Park was, before the city was built around Central Park, a lot of streams came from Central Park and flowed down going into the Hudson River, which is not that far away. And in the basement of our church that was built over 100 years ago, there's a creek that's still there. It was left in the basement floor. There was room left for that creek to run through. And it's just, it's one of the images of the river of life in the city for me, that underneath all of this stuff that's on top of it, the nature, God's word, still continues through. And you can walk down to this old furnace, and you know, it's a cellar, it's not a basement, you know. And, but then there's this gap created, and the creek flows through it.
That is wonderful. See, I think that's what ministry is about. A lot of times in people's lives, the river of life has gone underground, and they don't see it anymore. All they see is that salt creek that's dried up. I mean, ministry, the New Jerusalem is about helping us see that even if the river of life has gone underground in our lives, it's still there. It's still flowing. That's beautiful. I mean, I preached on this text one time at my church. I know what it was. One of my students, he was on internship in Milwaukee, and he preached about this, and a woman came up to him and said, well, you know, there used to be a creek that flows through this neighborhood, but now they paved it over. But it's still there. It's still underground. Well, I mean, you know, we don't know where it is now, but this idea that it had gone underground. So then I was thinking about that. I preached about that in our neighborhood, and someone came up to me and said, there used to be a creek that flowed through Hyde Park, and it was where the seminary was built. You know, so think of this. Under my building where I work every day, there used to be a creek flowing, and it's gone underground now in some kind of sense. I mean, obviously, it's probably not like that, but I mean, there's an underground river there. The living waters are there in our midst. It's just a matter of helping people see it, and that's the vision of this text, I think, for us. Huh?
It's also God's pervasiveness in the city. It's you know, where there's a crack in the sidewalk, something green will grow. And, you know, you've got, I remember the courtyard where our kids used to play between our building and Riverside Church. There's a tree that they would cut down every year because it got in their way of playing ball. And every year, this tree would come back up, you know, and it was just in the asphalt and the blacktop, and it was crumbled, and this tree would continue to come up, and they kind of chop it down, and then the next year come up fuller, and then they chop it down. So it's, you know, even in the midst of hardship, in the midst of the concrete, you know, for me, the tree kind of continues to grow.
It's the tree of life. Somebody had a hand.
For really, people, rivers define the land. Not all our land is defined by section lines or interstates, which typically go east or west.
Yeah. It's how we describe our geography. I met someone from a United Church of Christ, senator, diocese, I don't even know what you call it. What is
conference.
It? Conference. Who theirs was divided into judicatories by watersheds, you know, and it's a little gimmicky, but what if we started doing that? If we started talking about our lives again in terms of our watershed, because of course that's how life used to be defined. Geography was defined by what river you were a part of. Huh. Thanks for that.
Uh-huh. I've been kind of wrestling with the text that's repeated twice in these visions about no day, no night. You know, something happens. The gentleman over here was asking about if something happens to sun and moon and all that. And one of the things that comes to me about that is that there's some kind of allusion to timelessness. And we measure time by the change of light and day and night from Genesis 1. So it seems like what he's saying is we're not going to be talking about time anymore. That what this vision is seeing is something that is, I don't know how to, I was going to ask you, you know, John of Patmos, the writing at the end of the first century, what categories of thinking he might be using to talk about, did he have some kind of understanding of what happens to time itself? And then to lay on top of that, the tree of life imagery, would that then suggest that there is there's a greater reality here, and we can do realized eschatology or, you know, whatever you want to do with that, but there's a greater thing here than what apparently meets our eyes. So you can find the rivers underneath the asphalt and these images that you're working with. That are now, but they're also future. But now and future is time language.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, as I look at this, and I read the work of the physicists who like to speculate about what's happening to the universe, and in terms of what happens to time itself, the time itself is changing as we go along. That there is some kind of some very big thinking going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know quite how to, and what does that then say to somebody in Asia Minor who's wrestling with stuff in Asia Minor? You know, is this hope now, or is this hope future? You know, or are we even asking the wrong question and asking that question?
Good good point. Dorothy Bass is doing a session on time this afternoon at the times of our lives. Actually, this is one thing that I don't particularly like about this vision, this idea, because I think the rhythm of day and night is so wonderful. But I think what you bring up, I mean, obviously every biblical writer, every one of us has to struggle with this issue of how, in a sense, it's what you mentioned, the phrase realized eschatology, you know, that's the technical term, but in a sense, the kingdom is already in our midst because Jesus Christ has already died and been raised. But in a sense, it's not fully here yet. And so, like Paul talks about Jesus as the first fruits, that's one way you can describe it. But they all had to come to terms with this sort of sense of the all-readiness and yet the not-yetness. And that's here, too, in the New Jerusalem vision. Obviously, it's not yet. I mean, we don't live there. But I think there is a sense in which the whole book is structured with those two levels, you know, of heaven and earth, that in a sense, every time we participate in worship, we're in the already again. We're going up to heaven. We're glimpsing the throne room of God, and then we come back to earth, and it's not yet. But, I mean, there's a sense in which we do participate in it already in this vision. So, yeah, there's a very, there's a time urgency sense to the book of Revelation. I said the first couple days, I think some of that is about the urgency of wanting to say Rome won't last forever. You know, you can hold out because it's just a little while longer. And then there's an urgency, too, of knowing that it's not just eternity that we live in, but that there is time in our lives. So how that fits in with the New Jerusalem vision, I'm not really sure. But I think there's definitely this this both and, you know, the kind of here and now and the sort of wondrous future of something unfolding. But I think we get glimpses of it. I do think that, at least that's how I read this text, that it's something we're intended to glimpse, whether in the Eucharist when we take the water of life, the bread of life, or in baptism, or in our cities and towns when a river comes to life again. A guy at the first session is from Cleveland, and he was telling about how just 30 years ago that river was on fire from pollution. I mean, it was considered dead and gone, and now it's come back to life. And people live along it. Same thing with Chicago, with Lake Michigan, where I live. People are swimming in that every day. It's a wonderful sign of renewal that things really can come back to life. Others, where do you see the tree of life, the water of life in your life? I mean, it's a lot of things. I had a guy a couple years ago who was, we didn't know if he would, he had terrible cancer. We didn't know if he would live or die. It happens that he's living. But he told me, you know, Barbara, what the river of the water of life was for me during that year was the cards I got every day in the mail. People wrote me a constant river of cards, and that kept me alive. That was the river of life. It can be a lot of different things for you. But just start imagining with these images what it means for you, the river of the water of life, whether it's underground in your life, you can't see it right now, or whether it's in your midst, or both. Or whether it's Railroad Creek, you know, when you go to sit on a rock here and get a new glimpse of the tree of life there. And this Holden is the great irony. I mean, this is, you know, we've got the tailings right here. We've got death. We've got life. My favorite altar that I sort of got, you know, my faith from formed here at Holden, that was carved by Arnold Flodden, an artist from Northfield, Minnesota, out of timbers from the mine. So trees were cut down here to build the timbers that made the mine closed, and altars carved out of these same timbers. I mean, the tree of life continues to die and rise in a lot of different forms, and that's how it is in our lives, too, where we think there's only death and there's life suddenly.
Barbara?
Uh-huh?
Similarly, the copper tree that is over by the ark right now that was sculpted by Sister Paula Turnbull is made from the
From the mine.
Yeah, from refuse that's up there.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah, it's beautiful. Let me just read out a couple excerpts here. I'll just get your imaginations. Oh, no, it's time to stop.
Oh, read it anyway.
Oh, well, this is from Larry Rasmussen talking about when he went to the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. In the center of the forum was the Tree of Life. Pilgrims from around the world, pilgrims from every kind, color, age, making promises and singing and dancing, meditating and praying. Around the tree were messages, millions of messages, each scrawled on a leaf cut from construction paper, each from a child somewhere on that marbled planet. That's what they've got over in Narnia right now. You know, the Tree of Life. Kids write their names on the leaves. I mean, maybe you can do something like that in your congregation. Envision the Tree of Life with everyone participating. It's leaves for healing. I mean, what it means to be part of that Tree of Life. There's all kinds of things you can do. I had a student, if you want, you can pick up copies of this, a student who did her internship in East Boston in a really tough neighborhood. She's been up here to hold it. Beth Otto Galarno is her name. And she did a Bible study with her congregation, trying to help them envision, what does God's holy city, the new East Boston, look like, coming down out of heaven from God? And she says the people just sat there, you know, they said, well, it can't be the new East Boston. It's got to be somewhere we go after we die. It's heaven. And of course, you know, preach this at my funeral. Of course it's heaven. It's where we go after we die. But the question is, what does God's new East Boston look like dawning? What's a renewed neighborhood? She says they just sat there for a long time, and finally they were able to imagine. We saw the holy city, the new East Boston, coming down out of heaven from God. It has clean streets in which people can walk. There are no drugs, no fires. Everyone has a place to live. Children can play. It's safe. There are trees, butterflies, and God is in the midst. I mean, that's the question, is to imagine your neighborhood. What is the holy city, God's new Chicago, descending from heaven, look like? And then how can we live in terms of that vision? Glimpses of it. That's how it's empowered people through the centuries, and that's what it can still do for us today. Okay, thanks. Got to let you go to coffee hour.